The Laura Murphy Show, episode 25.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. I'm one half of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as normal, is Carlos. How are things in Nashville, Carlos?
They're good, Bob, and I'm glad to be with you.
Well, folks, I had someone send me an article from the New York Times. So this ran on August 13th, 2016, and the title is Why Some Life Insurance Premiums Are Skyrocketing. And so that's, I said to Carlos, you know, we need to cover this. As you know by now, if you've been listening to the Laura Murphy Show or if you've read the work of Nelson Nash, you know that we're big proponents of IBC, the infinite banking concept, which is a way to, quote, become your own banker. But the way you actually implement it is you go get a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy. And so if you've been listening to our podcast, you know, particularly in episodes 17 and 18, where we give you a step-by-step guide, if you're new to IBC, how do you go about implementing one of these policies? We explicitly said over and over, make sure you do this with a dividend-paying whole life policy. But I realized in light of this New York Times story that we didn't say the opposite. We didn't specifically warn you against policies that you should not do it with. And so in the interest of completeness, we're going to cover that in this episode. So let me first just explain the big picture of what this New York Times article is talking about so you folks will have the context. So I'm just going to read you the first few paragraphs here. Like clockwork, Sarah and James Cook paid $452 a month for life insurance. That is, until a letter arrived last year telling the elderly Georgia couple the premiums on the policy they'd had for 25 years were rising sharply. They held a universal life policy, a popular type that includes an investment account that accumulates cash when interest rates are high. But with rates at historic lows, it was being drained quickly. When the Cook's daughter, Joanne Sparks, asked an expert to explain her options, she recalls, "He said to me, 'Please don't take this the wrong way, and not to be morbid, but your mother needs to die.'" Around the world, life insurers are wrestling with existential questions. Interest rates are near zero and in some places have turned negative, unprecedented until recent years. It is contributing to a crisis moment for a business once considered a bedrock of financial stability in an industry that supports the retirement of millions. Okay, so there's the opening few paragraphs from this New York Times article. So you can see why that caught my eye and why, you know, people who have been interested in IBC because of the work that Carlos and I are doing might be concerned and say, whoa, you're telling us life insurance is safe and conservative. And now we see these anecdotal horror stories here, people who've been paying in and they get a letter all of a sudden saying you got to pay a lot more. And they finally have to drop the policy because that's the only thing that makes sense. What's the deal, guys? Haven't you misled us? Well, no, I'm glad to report we have not been misleading you. If you had done what we talk about in episode 17 and 18, or just more generally reading the work of Nelson Nash and so on, you will know that IBC is predicated upon doing this with a dividend-paying whole life policy. So that's totally distinct from what this New York Times article is talking about is a UL or a universal life policy. So in this episode, we're going to explain to you the difference and why you don't want to do a UL policy, or you don't want to do IBC, I should say, with a UL policy. And the other thing I want to really drive home in this episode, that this is not just us after the fact trying to, you know, cover our bases. This is stuff that Nelson has been saying from day one. And in fact, in all sincerity, I can say that this kind of stuff reassures me that Nelson Nash really is a very wise individual, because you'll see, we're going to read you some quotes in a minute here, folks, that Nelson really saw the problem even when UL was first introduced. And, you know, he's been warning people his entire time where he's been promoting IBC, saying, do this with a whole life policy, don't do it with a UL policy. So I'll stop there now, Carlson. Do you want to just give some introductory remarks, just telling people how the insurance sector is pretty varied?
Okay. Well, Bob, that's, first of all, that article, I read it. I see what it's saying. And, you know, I guess this is one reason why we often stress that people really ought to subscribe to the Laura Murphy Report, because we've done extensive research, you know, into the life insurance industry. We've looked at all aspects of this very carefully, and I would suggest that people either go to our website and look at some of the free issues that are there. They may be able to find some of the articles we've written there, but also just to subscribe to the issue. One thing that would help here is to just kind of get a visual of what we're talking about, and that is to remember that the insurance sector is huge. It's huge. But it is broken up into different components. For example, we have property and casualty insurance, which is a big, big part of the insurance sector. We also have, you know, health and disability. That's a whole different part. And then we also have long-term care insurance, also representing a big part of the insurance sector. And then we have life insurance. Now, it is life insurance, that particular part that that Robert and I, and when we talk about IBC, that's the part of the insurance sector that we need to be focused on. And as we've said in other podcasts before, if we kind of walk through the history of the life insurance industry, before 1960, there were really only two types of life insurance policies. And this is going all the way back to when life insurance was first introduced into this country, really at the inception of the country. Only two products. One of them was the very familiar term insurance, and the other one was the whole life policy. And that's all you had. Now, you did have annuities in that mix as well. But it wasn't really until President Nixon took us off the gold standard and we started to feel the rise in inflation and the rise in interest rates coming around, and therefore the rise in the stock market down to the individual level, an interest there, that we started to see the development of some of these other life insurance policies other than the two, the original two. And of course, one of the first ones that came into the mix there in the 1970s was the universal life policy. And the universal life policy came about again because, believe it or not, it was a fellow by the name of Ralph Nader that started pointing to the fact that it seemed as though Americans were not getting the right rate of return on their interest in their whole life policies, and that there must be something sneaky going on. And so this began the process of wanting to push the government into approaching the life insurance industry with unbundling the whole life product in such a way so they could see all the mechanical parts of it as to why that interest wasn't being generated. And so
can I stop you there, Carlos,
sure,
for a second? I think we might be losing some newcomers. So again, folks, you might have the broad distinction between a permanent life insurance policy versus a term life insurance policy. So a term policy just means you pay the premium, and then for a certain term, you've got death benefit coverage that, you know, if the insured dies, then the beneficiary gets the check from the life insurance company, but it's only set in place for a specific term. Whereas permanent life insurance, as the name suggests, means as long as you keep making the contractual premium payments, you have coverage up through the end of your life, even if you live to be 121 years old or whatever. And so that's the broad distinction. But then within the ranks of permanent life insurance, you now have different elements, different types of products. So as Carlos said, historically, there was just one. It was whole life. And so there the name, you know, you have it for your whole life. That it makes sense. But universal life was something that came to vogue in the late 70s and early 80s. In particular, it was prodded on by, as Carlos said, in 1979, the Federal Trade Commission comes out with this report. So the way the whole life policy worked, you're just making your premium payments and you have the death benefit coverage in force, and then they had guaranteed cash surrender values. And so you could look at the illustration before you bought the policy and it would say, hey, if for some reason you want to collapse the policy 8 years into it, this is how much money they would give you at that point. And if you waited and you were paying premiums and then decided to pull out 20 years into the life of the policy, it would be a much bigger number. So, you know, why is the life insurance company doing that? Well, because they're investing your premiums, buying assets, knowing when you die, they have to send the beneficiary the death benefit amount. And so they have to have that money working so they can be in a position to do that. So if you prematurely, while you're still alive, tell them, hey, you know what? I want out. I don't want to make the premium payments anymore. They now, that's a huge liability off their books because now they don't have to pay you when you die. And so that's why they're able to give you a spot payment that's lower than the death benefit, but that still reflects the fact that now you're taking that liability off their books, and so they're willing to pay you that. Okay, but the problem is that, remember, there was high inflation in the 70s, as Carlos said, because Nixon takes us off the gold standard. And so this FTC report comes out and says, whoa, consumers are getting ripped off by these whole life policies, because if you actually run the numbers and look at the internal rate of return, like how fast is your cash surrender value growing based on the premiums you're kicking in and so on, the rate of return, looking at it purely as an investment vehicle, is pretty paltry, especially when you contrast it with what people are earning, you know, in the open market, because look at how regular interest rates are. You know, so that was the kind of thing they do. Now, it's not worth getting into in this podcast, but there were a lot of problems with the analysis, right? So industry insiders and actuaries and stuff were saying, whoa, 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 you guys aren't even running these numbers right. This is very unfair to our product. But put that aside, whether it was right or wrong isn't the issue. What happened is a lot of people were saying, this thing is a black box. You know, I'm just paying my contractual premium payments every month or every year, and that is simultaneously buying me death benefit coverage plus this guaranteed increase in the cash surrender value over time, you know, that I can use to borrow against and so on. And so it's hard to isolate what's the rate of return in terms of this thing as an investment vehicle versus what am I paying for the pure death benefit coverage. So the point of universal life or UL policies was to make it more transparent. There, they were going to split those two functions up. And so you could see in the way the policy worked and contractually what you were getting was, yeah, you were paying for the death benefit coverage and they would charge you a certain amount just for the pure life insurance component. And then there was like a side fund. And so some of your premium that you kicked in would be then, you know, used to go and buy assets, and they would credit your account based on some formula. So the point of it was to supposed to reassure customers that, hey, now you can really watch this thing more closely and know what you're getting for your money. And it's better for you this way. You can keep better track of it than you can with these black box whole life policy. And just to give you one statistic, and then I'll turn it back over to you, Carlos. So traditional whole life, it had about 85% of the market in 1979. And by 1986, it had fallen down to about 50%. And that fall was almost perfectly counterbalanced by the rise of universal life. Okay, so, and again, it made a lot of, it was understandable why in this high interest rate environment, people would come up, life insurance agents selling universal life to people and say, look it, we can give you a much better rate of return in terms of the investment component with these UL policies, with interest rates being nice and high right now in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, compared to these whole life policies that you may have taken out a decade or two ago. And look at the paltry rate of return you're getting on these things. And so a lot of people started flocking into UL, but there was a danger. So I'll stop there and turn it back over to you, Carlos.
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea to spend a little time with the historical events here. As you mentioned, there was this tremendous drop in the sale of whole life, you know, when universal life emerged. I think it's important to realize that during that period of time, we did have a lot of mutual companies. Now, we've always had mutuals and stock companies. But because we're starting to see the emergence of the stock market here, the stock life insurance companies, they actually saw a way to gain a competitive edge here by bringing out the universal life policy and tying it to stock market returns. Now, with the mutual company, the difference there you have in the mutual company is that the policy owners are also the owners of the company. So when we talk in terms of a mutual life insurance company and we're talking about the dividend-paying whole life product, we're referring to a product that is participating. They participate really in the profits of the mutual, whereas you don't have that situation in a stock life insurance company. You know, a stock life insurance company is driven, you know, by stockholders. You're trying to please the stockholders more than anything else. So a whole life product in a stock company, as you can see, is just a product. You know, it doesn't have that ownership, that mutuality in it. But the stock companies were able to bring out the universal life as an unbundled whole life product, more or less, that was directly tied, you know, to the returns of the market that were occurring there. And then one other piece of historical data that it's important to realize is while all this is going on, and we have Ralph Nader pointing to the whole, you know, to the life insurance companies and why the people aren't getting the interest return. Remembering that the life insurance industry is regulated by the states, not the federal government, life insurance companies, they still had to adhere to usury laws. So they were kind of locked into a 6% rate that they couldn't go above, you know, when people wanted to borrow money, you know, from their cash values, from using their cash values, you know, and borrow money from the life insurance companies. You know, the usury laws prevented them from charging more than the 6%. So all that was sort of locked in. And at the same time, you've got this component of people drawing attention to individuals not getting a higher rate of return. And then you have the introduction of the universal life policy. Well, all of a sudden, there was a lot of people converting over to the universal life policy product. And today, it's virtually, you know, the number one selling permanent life insurance product and is the framework for any of the other more exotic type of life insurance products like variable universal life and index universal life and those types of product. With the dividend paying whole life policy, a life insurance company is usually a mutual company. Basically, it's the only product that they actually guarantee. Whereas in any of these other more exotic products, life insurance products, starting with the universal life products, the life insurance company is not guaranteeing that. In fact, the policy holder is really on the hook there. So that's a major distinction. And then one last other piece of information. Today, we have about 1,000 life insurance companies, but only about 30 are mutual or mutual holding companies. And so when you start thinking about the whole life product as a life insurance product itself, it's a rare product that's mostly concentrated with the mutuals and the mutual holding companies.
So thanks, Carl. So that's a lot of information for people. Let me just tie this back into the New York Times article so you can see that what Carl and I are talking about here lines up very consistently with what this New York Times piece is saying. So I'm just reading now from a little bit. This is like around the sixth or seventh paragraph. It says, people who bought universal life policies in the 1980s and 1990s, some of which guaranteed annual returns of 4% or more, are seeing their premiums soar. It has precipitated about a dozen lawsuits against insurers, some seeking class action status. Many of the lawsuits claim that the insurers are raising their rates to force people to drop their policies entirely, often when they are too old to buy replacements. A canceled policy means an insurer gets to keep years of premiums without facing a future death benefit payout. All right, so at this point, Carlos, just to show you that we're not sort of trying to be defensive after the fact, I know you've got Nelson's book in front of you. Can you read just the part where Nelson talks about UL and says how the policies could, you know, he was running the numbers and said these things are going to fall apart as people get older?
Yes, sure. It's actually in Becoming Your Own Banker on page 39. The paragraph is titled My Thoughts on Universal Life and Variable Life. And there Nelson just begins, you know, talking about this is not the policy you want to use for practicing IBC. And he's pointing to that very same period that you just read about. And he starts out by saying this happened during a time of high interest rates, and it looked good in the early years of a policy. When I first saw the policy, he's talking about universal life, I ran some illustrations and they kept falling apart when the insured attained age 65 to age 70. The cost of 1 year term became prohibitive at the advanced ages and it ate up the cash fund from that point forward. Therefore, I never sold one of them when I was in the business, and I surely wouldn't buy one now.
Okay, thanks. So there, folks, again, we're just trying to hammer home because we realize, you know, you read stories like this, if you're not familiar with how the life insurance sector works, you know, the New York Times runs a piece saying life insurance premiums are skyrocketing, and you might say, whoa, 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 I thought this was supposed to be safe and conservative, and we're just stressing that this is why somebody like Nelson Nash was so aghast when they did introduce these products like Universal Life and then even the more exotic ones, because he knew this was going to happen where, you know, the life insurance sector was in a sense trying to compete with Wall Street and make their returns look sexy and make the product look interesting when that's not what life insurance should have been doing. And he knew, as Carlos just read there, that this stuff might look good while interest rates were relatively high for a period there in the 80s when UL really, you know, started taking over the scene, but that down the road it was going to fall apart. So let me just very briefly, so people understand like mechanically what the heck is going on here and why is whole life not dangerous in this respect? Because it's the way contractually it works with a whole life policy. That thing contractually, you are agreeing as the policyholder, as the owner of the policy, that you're going to make a level fixed premium payment, and then depending on the contract, like it might be paid up at 65, it might be just a standard payment you make so long as you're still alive. It depends, but the point is the premium you have to pay is locked in. And so, you know, what happens is as you get older and, you know, you become more likely to die, well, the actuaries of the life insurance company, they take all that into account. They make those projections. And so when they tell you the number, say, this is what you got to pay every month or every year to keep this policy in force, they're trying to take that into consideration to say, okay, what happens if we're wrong about mortality rate? But the point is the life insurance company is the one that's taking the risk, right? They're giving you the fixed amount. And then once you sign that contract, they're on the hook and, you know, they can't come to you down the road and say, you know what? It turned out people in your age cohort are dying more quickly than we realize, so we got to change, you know, the numbers here. You owe us. They can't do that. That's the contract locked it in. They're the ones bearing the risk. Likewise, they're going to make projections about what our long-term interest rate's going to be. You know, they're going to say, all right, if they got a 25-year-old taking on a whole life policy, this thing could be in force for another, you know, 60 years, and so we got to make projections about what our interest return is going to be, because we're going to be taking this guy's premiums and investing them in bonds and whatever in order to earn a return so we can pay the death benefit claim. So they have to make some projections, and, you know, and then when they guarantee what's the cash value going to increase and so on. And they might be wrong. Maybe 30 years out, all of a sudden interest rates are a lot lower than they thought they would be at the inception of that policy. So again, who is on the hook for that? It is the life insurance company. If we're talking about a standard whole life policy, because all the guarantees and all the numbers, rates of growth and so on, are all fixed contractually. And then if things do better, they give you dividend payments, as Carlos says, if it's a mutual company that has a, you know, and you've got a participating policy. But the point is, you know, the guaranteed minimums you're going to earn are all locked in contractually. So the life insurance, if interest rates end up being lower than they thought, it's the life insurance company that has to eat it. They can't come to you and say, hey, you know what? We screwed up. And that's why we got to charge you more now, because otherwise this doesn't work for us. In contrast, it's the opposite with the UL policy. So yes, the appeal of it was, oh, it's more transparent. We separated out the pure cost of life insurance or death benefit coverage based on mortality and so on. And then over here, we've got the side fund. And so you can really closely monitor and see what the rate of return has been on your investments. But that wasn't the only change they made. They also made it so that the thing is not locked in from day one, that it can reset. And so that, you know, they can come down the road and charge you more based on, you know, changing mortality or if interest rates change. So what ends up happening is you might, and also they don't have a fixed amount that you pay each month. You can, if your investment is doing well, you know, like they're crediting, you know, interest rates are high and they're crediting your quote side fund. And so you're building up cash pretty quickly. You can contribute less if you want to. And say, oh, I don't need to kick in that much anymore because I've got building up so much in the cash value. And they're fine. They'll give you the freedom to do that. So that's where this, quote, flexibility comes in. But then if you're not watching that thing, maybe down the road, conditions change, interest rates are lower, so they're not crediting your side fund. It's not growing as quickly. And then it just the pure cost of insurance starts eating into that cash value. And if you're not watching it, all of a sudden it might eat that thing away, at which point the life insurance company sends you a letter saying, hey, this thing is about to collapse. You need to kick in a big bunch of money to keep this thing afloat. And you might be surprised. You might have thought, what the heck? I've been contributing to this thing for 20 years, the same amount I've been pumping in since 1983. What's the problem? Well, the problem is interest rates came way down and you weren't watching it, right? So that's the big picture. Obviously, there's a lot of nuances and whatever. I'm just trying to give a quick summary of the big picture difference and why I think it's fair to say that with a whole life policy, the risk is on the life insurance company to meet the terms of the contract, whereas with a UL policy, yeah, there's a sense in which it's more flexible, but it's like giving you the freedom to have the thing blow up in your face. So how do you feel about that, Carl? Is that a fair summary?
Well, I think that's a really good explanation there. You know, I think, Bob, one of the big selling features to Universal Life at the time that it came out is that somehow they persuaded people that they could actually reduce the cost of insurance with a universal life. In other words, you're still dealing with the same kinds of expenses and mortality charges and those kinds of things in the cost of insurance, but simply because they could see all these pieces, all these parts. They weren't just kind of all, you know, bundled up together. They could see them exposed and what each one of those components, you know, what they actually cost. And because the interest rates were so high, they were selling them to people saying, you know, you can actually reduce the cost of your insurance and also increase your cash value by having a universal life as opposed to a whole life policy. And so, you know, to get a universal life policy, you know, obviously you would start off with the premium in order to get the thing going. And that premium, you know, you just had sort of like a flow of funds every single month where you'd start off with the premium and then they would subtract from that the cost of the loading, which is the, you know, the commissions or the sales charges that are paid to the financial professional who's setting this up. And then they would, and you could see that, and then you could see the expense charge that was being charged. That was a dollar amount. And then after that, you could see the mortality charge that they were charging, and that was a dollar amount. And that particular amount was based on the amount of net risk that the life insurance company was on the hook for still against the cash value and the death benefit of it. And then they would add the interest that you were earning on a daily basis. So you could actually see all these moving parts. And at the end of the month, once you took that premium, you subtracted all these expenses out of it, you wound up at the end of a month with an account value, and then you would start the next month over, and you would go through that same process again. And because interest rates were rising, you know, the cash value was building, and you had the flexibility not to put the same premium out that you put in the previous month, and it would still roll. In other words, so you had that premium flexibility in there. So as the interest rates, you know, obviously begin to drop, you, as you can well see, you know, then the policy starts not to have enough money to function. Okay, so with a whole life policy, because they're bundled, because the life insurance company is guaranteeing all of this, it's the kind of policy you can put in a drawer and forget about it. It's just going to roll and grow. Whereas with a universal life policy, you need to be watching that thing all the time. And so if you didn't watch it all the time, you would have a situation like what we're reading about in this particular article. The problem is that most individuals, they really don't understand how these policies work to start with. They can be kind of complicated. So if they weren't watching those universal life policies and the interest rates start to go down, yep, they're gonna fail.
Right. So we should probably clarify. I don't want to get a bunch of angry emails from people in the life insurance sector. We're not saying that, oh, the only thing anybody should ever buy is a whole life policy, period. There's different scenarios. You know, we stress this in the Laura Murphy report and whatever, especially like for term policy. If you're a young breadwinner and you, you know, you got a spouse and kids to support and a mortgage, let's say, you may need to get a term policy with enough death benefit coverage in case you die next week. You might not be able to afford a whole life policy that's big enough to cover, you know, the pure death benefit that you would need in that situation. So there, a term might be the only thing. And maybe over time, if you start doing IBC, is your death benefit coverage via the whole life policy or policies you start to accumulate. Maybe then you scale back the term or what have you. But so don't misunderstand. And even I know there's situations, this, I don't want to get into it in this episode because I don't want to confuse people by throwing more information in. But there are things where, you know, you might have a trust and maybe, you know, a universal policy makes more sense to be embedded inside of a trust, things like that. So to be clear, we're not saying the product is horrible and don't you ever use it. What we're saying is if you're interested in IBC, for sure, the type of product you want is not any old life insurance policy. What you want is a dividend paying whole life policy. We've been saying that from day one. Nelson's been saying it, but we're just clarifying to make sure, in case you just don't know, when we say a dividend paying whole life, that means not a universal life and certainly not the even more exotic stuff like variable universal life or index universal life and so on. You have anything you want to say on that issue, Carlos?
No, I think that explains it, Bob.
Okay, well, I guess that's a good time for us to wrap up then for this episode. Again, let me just push people, if you haven't, you know, if you're new to the podcast and you haven't gone back through the archives, in particular, you want to check out our episodes 17 and 18, where we're talking to newcomers and saying, from scratch, we're going to assume you know nothing. What do you need to know about IBC to get started? So I point you to those if you haven't already listened to them. Beyond that, we would just encourage you to share this podcast with your colleagues and family and friends, because who doesn't need to know about the intersection of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, especially in our times now where the financial sector is just upside down, absolutely insane. People talking about helicopter money, negative interest rates. It's really, I'm waiting for the economics profession to say, ha, surprise, we were just kidding you guys for the last 10 years. Of course, this has all been a big joke, but I don't think that's what's going to happen. So thanks, everybody, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.